Blog Talk Radio.
To an astounding future that lies ahead, one that will be here sooner than you think, and one that you have an important role to play in bringing about. At The World Transformed, we want to introduce you to what may be the greatest transformation of them all, the one that begins with considering and acting on the almost limitless possibilities that lie ahead, and that ends somewhere beyond the reach of the human imagination. So, when does this amazing future begin? Well, today is the day. My name is Phil Bauermaster, and with me in the virtual studio is my co-blogger, co-futurist, and co-host, Stephen Gordon. Hello, Stephen.
Hey, Phil. How are you?
Well, I'm super fantastic. How are you, my friend?
I am doing great also. It has been
I've got some movie news I'm going to share with you. I think we're going to talk a little media this evening in addition to our main topic, a little bit of movies. So I've got some I got a movie headline I want to share with you. I found this quite fascinating. First off, I want to tell people who don't realize it, that the movie The Walk is true. It's a true story based on the actual adventure of this guy named, this Frenchman named Philippe Petit, who hung a line between the two towers of the old World Trade Center in Manhattan and tightrope walked across. Okay, that's a true story. That is a true story. So anyone who doesn't know that really happened, that really did happen. So here's the headline I want to read to you, Stephen, just in a public service kind of a way. An alarming number of people think The Martian is a true story.
Okay. Well, it says,
yes,
something
people
about
have tightrope walked the Twin Towers. No, we have never been to Mars. I think is
not,
I don't know,
yet.
Where I want to start.
Well, Phil, I know that you have not seen The Martian. I just asked right before the show. You have not. Shame on you. But anyway,
it was my wife's turn to pick, and we went to see Man from U.N.C.L.E. So.
She picked another good one. That Man from U.N.C.L.E. is a great movie. I enjoyed that a little earlier in the summer. My wife, she picked that one also, and we had a great time.
I wonder why wives are picking that movie. Interesting.
Well, there's some good-looking guys in that movie. Things to make it go for.
You saw The Martian over the weekend?
Saw The Martian. Now, let me give you a little background. I had read the book. It's funny I would say I'd seen it before because the book is so cinematic. When you read it, you visualize it as you do because it was that good. And I was finishing the book up, I said, this guy must be a scientist or something. The science is so good. He gets it right, you know. And come to find out, he's got a parent who's a physicist. He's worked in science as well, you know. So it was one of those deals that would have been, you know, it would have shamed the family probably had he published anything that was, you know, not absolutely correct scientifically.
Right.
And so it is, and which is just part of what makes it amazing. You know, Tom Clancy novels were always known for, you know, by those who, you know, military people, things like that, always admired how he got things right. And that's one of the things that it's cool about this story. But I don't want to give away too much, Phil, just to say that, you know, how you sometimes when you read a book and then you go see the movie, you come away a little disappointed. Well, the book was better, it was, and that's not the case here. Ridley Scott did a marvelous job taking a very good book and translating it for the big screen, and that job and always is going to involve you know, leaving things out. You have to.
Yep.
Or you'd have an eight-hour movie, right? And,
right,
and
exactly.
So they had to leave things out, but the choices they made were good choices. And to the extent that there were one or two things that were actually changed from the book, different from the book, not just omitted, but different, it was just so small and if anything, maybe improved upon the story in the book. It's like they said, okay, because of the omission, we need to change something to kind of explain and by doing so, streamline the story and made it a tighter narrative. And really expertly done, both by the original author and by the folks that put it on the screen. Just absolutely incredible. I think it's good enough, Phil. This story is good enough that it's kickstarting the conversation about actually going to Mars. And it might be one of those things that we look back on and say, you know what, it was it's not the reason we went to Mars, but it was something that kind of got the ball rolling, maybe. And so I just really, really was impressed by the movie. Would say maybe my favorite movie in the last 5 years or so. That, you know, looking back that long, easily beats things like Gravity, Interstellar, both movies that I liked. But this movie is far superior to those.
All right. So. Well, that is a strong recommendation, Stephen. That's bold things you're saying about this movie. My understanding is that you get a real feel for what it would actually be like to be on Mars. Obviously, that there is a good deal of loving attention paid in the filmmaking to present a realistic picture of the dangers and just kind of the hardships that maybe you wouldn't necessarily think about that are associated with being on the planet Mars.
Right. And, you know, I would say this, Phil, if you were worried about, well, maybe I shouldn't read the book, that would kind of mess me up with the movie. No, if you... if you have a few minutes and you want to pick up the book, and I would say, you know, don't pick it up right at bedtime, because you'll 4 in the morning you'll be finishing it up and you'll be ruined for the next day. It's a great book, but it reading it before going to see the movie is not going to hurt you. You'll enjoy both,
and
highly recommend both the book and the movie.
All right. Okay, so everybody read the by Stephen's recommendation, read the book, see the movie in any order that you choose.
Yeah, in any order.
But definitely want to catch the movie while it's in theaters and you can see it on the big screen. Sounds like I've got my weekend plans now.
It is definitely a big screen movie. I saw it in 2D. So I can't vouch for how good the 3D version is. But at any rate, I would just say the 2D version is awesome. So, okay.
I'm still, by and large, not sold on 3D, I got to say. I would say
the one positive experience I've had with 3D was probably Avatar. Every other time I went and saw a 3D movie, I was always going, you know what, not worth it. I'm a 2D guy myself. Yep.
Yeah, there you go.
All right.
So, hey, speaking of movies and TV and stuff, we were going to do a quick rundown on our experience with the TV show Limitless. Speaking of movies, that was a big hit movie a few years ago, and now it's become a TV series. We've both seen the pilot, and you've seen a couple episodes. I think I've seen the pilot and half an episode of the series, so I feel like I'm in great position to talk about this show. I was really taken by the... Go ahead. I was taken by the pilot. I think it captured all of the stuff that made the movie itself special, right? It captured the kind of the intrigue about what happens if you suddenly boost yourself this way, and yet they found a way, a pretty clever way, I think, to make it a weekly series. I can tell you, the person I watched it with, my wife was not as impressed. She said, oh, well, now it's just going to be Elementary, right? And I can see, you know, it's like, oh, that's true. He's kind of a cop now, and he's basically got the same superpower that Sherlock Holmes has, which is that he can figure anything out, right? So it's it becomes kind of a crime drama where the guy can he's like a super detective basically. But there's still an arc of the whole, you know, the whole senator's there in the background and the fact that it's this enhancement drug, I think, you know, adds an interesting twist to the whole thing.
Well, and what's interesting, the original movie, it was sort of had a dark ending, a little bit dark at the end. It could have gone a lot darker, but it was a little bit dark at the end. And so we are presented with Bradley Cooper's character in the pilot, and you know, you get the feeling. And especially once you've seen the second episode, Phil, you get the feeling that what we're dealing with there is a frenemy, okay?
Mm.
And Bradley Cooper is, you know, although he was the protagonist in the movie. Yeah, I don't know if we're dealing with a really good guy there or not, you know. Mm. And so that's an interesting spin on this, you know, is to have. You know, have a background character that was the protagonist in the original movie that this is based on, perhaps being, an enemy in this show, and it's going to be really, really good, and I think it will have some episodes, I think, where Soraya is exactly right. It's going to be a lot of, you know, you're going to have elementary, Monster of the Week shows, but you also have myth-building shows that deal with this background arc. And, I really look forward to it. They've got it set up really good. And
I'm looking forward to see how that develops, you know, the whole frenemy thing. Because the thing is, you know, the thing about an enhancement is it doesn't necessarily make you nicer, right?
Yeah,
and I'm not saying
the drug
necessarily makes you worse, but you think about the Bradley Cooper character in the movie. We were sympathetic with him, but he wasn't really the world's nicest guy, was he? I mean, he was a nice enough guy most of the time, but mostly we were just kind of sympathetic with him, and that's interesting that it would take that turn. And there's a little bit of the old power corrupts possibly going on there too. Well, we'll see what happens. We'll see how that unfolds, but that's
like The Martian, getting us talking about Mars, The Limitless. I mean, anybody that has even a passing interest in that TV show will ask, you know, well, you know, would you take that clear pill if you have the opportunity? And the temptation would be huge, wouldn't it? Especially if you had the injection, you know, and anyone who's seen the pilot knows what I'm talking about. When I say the injection, but if you knew that it was going to be, you know, relatively safe, you know, for an experimental drug that enhances you, would you take it? And
right.
And I would say the temptation would be huge. It would be huge. So, and
I would do it.
I think,
I'm not going to say the temptation would be huge. I'll just tell you right now.
You just say you're on board. Huh?
Yeah. I'm on it. Offer it to me and I'll take it for sure. Because yeah. You know what? Hey, I can quit any time, right? Isn't that what they always say?
And that's the thing that the people that they showed in the movie, an old fiance or actually it was an ex-wife. They were married for like a month, you know,
right.
Bradley Cooper's character, and he had been married for like a month. Anyway, they introduced her in the movie, and she had been on that stuff and managed to get herself off. But I mean, she was a shell of a person, wasn't she? She was, I just basically, all she had was the memories of how awesome it was, you know, but it was either get off of it or die, basically, for her.
Right.
And,
right. Yeah, I definitely wouldn't do it without the knowing what we know about it. I wouldn't do it without the shots. But give me the stuff and the shots, and I'm there. I think
you're on board, okay?
You know, it's like you live your whole life thinking, I'm just this close to being like, you know, you're always looking for the tipping point, right? I figure a lot of people would think, well, this will be the thing that really pushes me over the edge, right? You know, for good or for ill. I think it would be for good. I mean, that's the direction I'd be going anyway.
Well, you know, we've always said, you know, what's the ultimate superpower? We've always said super intelligence, right? So
there you go. That's right.
You know, you can, with superintelligence, you can everything else is negotiable. You can get all the rest.
Figure out all the rest of the powers that I need from there. That's the one to have to get to the other ones. You know, because like heat vision, you know, is awesome, but it doesn't scale to other things. You know, it's like right. If you had heat vision, you know, it'd be great for tricks and stuff. But I don't even think you could get rich with heat vision, right? But if you're super intelligent, you could give yourself heat vision, for example.
Exactly. Or some reasonable facsimile. And that's what's interesting about one of the interesting things. I'm kind of spoiling the movie at this point. I'm not going to spoil the series, but I'm going to spoil the movie just a little bit. Turn away from the show for just a second if you haven't seen the movie. But you know, in the movie, he initially takes this drug, and what is it, MVP? Is that what they call it? I believe so. I think that's it. But anyway, so he takes this drug, and it makes you super intelligent, but it takes more and more of it. You have to take it more often over a period of time, and eventually it starts having these huge side effects. But here's the thing. If you have super intelligence, you know, who is the person most qualified in the entire world to come up with a solution to the problem of this NZT? Of course, it's the smartest person in the world, right? And
it's the person qualified to solve any problem. I mean,
that's right. And so, and of course, Bradley Cooper solves that problem, and that's really the setup for the television series. Is that problem has been solved, at least for those who know about, you know, the super duper secret probation. injection that Bradley Cooper's character has. And
you know, when you think about it, Stephen, now that you mention that, that's really kind of a plot hole in the movie, isn't it? Because everyone who took the drug should have thought of that, right? They're all super intelligent. It should have occurred to, you know, why is he the only one that he even occurred to do that, right?
Figure that issue out, yeah. Well, yeah. If you have a huge problem, what are the two things you can throw at it? You know, if it's an engineering problem or something like that, well, you throw money and geniuses at it. And if you throw enough money and enough geniuses at it, eventually you'll solve it. Well, someone had to be first. So it's not really a plot hole so much as, he was the one out of all those who had taken the drug that managed to figure out the solution to that issue. Or maybe, you know, he survived long enough to be able to do it, you know.
But actually,
and
it goes to, you know, the fact that intelligence is a very hard to quantify, hard to get a handle on thing. It can be extremely specific. It can be very broad. I was just thinking, I don't know if you've seen this week's Big Bang Theory.
Richard Feynman's band.
Yeah, we won't give it away, but. But basically, here are very intelligent people applying extremely intelligent tactics to a problem, right? And they're too narrow,
problem.
A little too narrow, right? They didn't find a broad enough of a solution. I don't want to give it away for those who haven't seen it, but that is one of the most laugh-out-loud cutaways I can remember in TV in a long time. That was actually so funny. So if you haven't seen Big Bang Theory this week, check it out.
Hey, there was a little placard at the end of the show, Phil. I don't know if you caught it, but it said, yes, that was really Richard Feynman's van. No, his van is fine.
Oh, okay. that's good. Oh, that's awesome. They really used his real van.
They really used his real van, and no, we did not hurt his van.
I'm astounded on the one count and very relieved on the other count. Actually, I didn't think they really would have done anything to his van. Okay, hey, listen, we're running out of show here, and we've actually got a whole show.
And we've got stuff to talk about.
We need to jump into this. We're talking about the good news and the bad news, and getting the balance right. As longtime listeners know, we follow the 80-20 rule around here, or try to, you know, the Pareto principle. Basically, we believe that, if the question is, should I be a pessimist or an optimist, the answer is yes. You should look at positive scenarios, and you should look at negative scenarios. And we practice a 5-to-1 rule, basically, or is that right? 4-to-1 rule. Anyway, 1 out of 5 is negative, and the other 4 are positive. I think that's the right balance. You can't put the negative possibilities away completely. You got to be focused on what could go wrong. But I think there's not nearly enough. I think as a society, we're generally out of balance around that. That there are so many constructive, positive possibilities that we could be pursuing, and we tend to focus just on the negative ones, and we kind of lose sight. So 80-20 is just a good way of throwing it out there, because people are familiar with that rule. People in business, you know, you hear that, the Pareto rule, the 80-20 rule, and it's familiar to people. I think it's probably more like 1,000-to-1, actually. It's like you definitely want to keep a you know, some presence in the what could go wrong world, but there just needs to be a lot more focus on what could go right. So that's what we're about here. We try to mix it up and balance the two. And we've got some really fun positive developments. And then it occurred to me that our negative, scary, bad news one is probably, some people would consider it a little more on the fanciful side. It's not really news. It's just an idea. But that also kind of shows how you can balance. You know, it's coming technologies versus possibilities for things that could happen versus possibilities for why the universe works the way it does. Anything goes on this show, right? That we said we're going to talk about, basically. Anything goes if we put it in the show description or we decide to bring it up. I think those are the.
Well, I say we start with the positive stuff, Bill, and actually the negative stuff can kind of. There, some of the positive stuff actually will lead us into the discussion about the negative things. So I say we kick off with the seven things in that article. So technologies.
There's a great piece over on Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies. 7 emerging technologies that will change the world. Gray Scott wrote a wonderful piece putting this together. And actually, yeah, I just wanted to focus on one of those because I've got other pieces I want to. Other pieces of good news I want to talk about, but this is a great article, and highly recommend it to everyone. If you want a good overview of what can go right in the world, if you want a good overview of things that are really going to be making the world different in the near future. In fact, reading this article reminded me a lot of the miniseries World Transformed shows we used to do, where we would just try to cover all the big topics. And this is a slightly different list of big topics than ours, but it's actually pretty close. The 7 emerging technologies that will change the world were age reversal, artificial general intelligence, vertical pink farms, that's the one we're going to spend some time on, transhumanism, wearables and implantables, which we're also going to spend time on one of those in a minute, atmospheric water harvesting, and 3D printing. So it's a pretty good overlap actually for a lot of the stuff that we talk about on this show. But the one that caught my attention was vertical pink farms because it had an extra word in there. You and I have spoken about, we've been talking about vertical farms for 3 or 4 years anyway. I don't know, maybe 5 years. We've been talking about this. We've done at least
lots of advantages to being indoors, and like in skyscrapers, for example, your food's right there where the people are, and just so much in the way. You can save water because it's not all evaporating off. It's you don't have to worry with pesticides because it's all indoors, and you don't have pests getting to your plants. And so it's just so many positive things you could say about that. But yeah, this is something that and this is not speculative, Phil. They've got a picture here. They're actually doing.
Yeah, this is real. Yeah.
Yeah, so vertical pink farm. So tell us about the pink. What are they talking about?
Right. Well, as you said, Stephen, the idea of a vertical farm is intriguing enough. I mean, it's interesting enough because it's, I think, the first time that anyone has suggested on a large scale that there might be an alternative to what we think of as farming, right? To what we think of as, you go plow the earth and you put stuff in the earth. I mean, there's been hydroponics and, there have been ideas floated here and there through the years, but this is the first time that an idea has kind of taken hold and people said, no, you could do this. You could do this on a large scale, and it would actually work better than farming, right? It would be better than farming in many respects, you know, in terms of the yield, in terms of not needing insecticides, you know, all these things. Okay, well, interesting. Okay, if you have the infrastructure for it, vertical farms are cool, and, you know, you and I have been on board with that for a couple of years now, and then suddenly we had this word pink. They're pink because it turns out you don't need the full spectrum of light for plants to grow. All plants need to grow are the red and blue light. And so they're building vertical farms now, if you follow the link, there actually is a picture here of one, where the light being used is LED lighting, and it's a mixture of blue and red LEDs. If you get the mix of blue and red light right, that's all the light that plants need, and they will grow and thrive. And interestingly, that saves you a tremendous amount of energy in terms of pumping light into these plants. Suddenly, you're not trying to represent the whole spectrum. What are those? Red, orange, yellow, green, blue, and violet is what you would need in terms of LEDs to represent the full white light spectrum. So you've taken two out of the five, right? And you're able to give the plants exactly what they need and raise the plants. So these farms are pink. I would have thought if you mix blue and red, you'd get purple. So I would have thought these would be vertical purple farms. But I think pink.
I'm looking at this picture, and you could make the argument that that parts of it looks kind of purple. Look like in the center of the structure, it kind of has a purplish cast there. But anyway, and another great thing about LEDs, they don't put out they put out like negligible amounts of heat, like no heat at all almost. And so, you know, you wouldn't have to spend any, spend a lot of money on cooling the place, from the heat that would normally be caused by the light that you use. Grow lights will heat up a house. You know, the people that have, grown plants in their homes with grow lights will tell you, you know, that's it's not just the electricity from the grow light, but it's also the increased amount of air conditioning you need in your home too. It takes a lot of energy, but you don't have that with these LEDs. So that's neat stuff. So the picture that I'm seeing of this pink farm, I don't see any evidence of soil. I'm thinking that must be complete with the LED lights. That's doubly cool. And because it's so vertical, that, you know, no individual could, I wouldn't think, would climb up to that top level all that often. I imagine it's done robotically.
It's hard to say how that works. Maybe the shelves rotate somehow. Maybe they come down. You know, you just lower a shelf and pick some carrots and then put it back up. I'm not sure how that works. But I wouldn't climb up there. It gets pretty high. And this is obviously just some kind of a test environment. But the kinds of things they're talking about are, you know, you repurpose old 20-story buildings, right, 30-story buildings that aren't going to be used for residential or commercial. If they're still viable standing structures, boom, you got a farm. And the amount of food you can yield with one of these is quite spectacular. And as you mentioned, Stephen, it's all, you know, it's the whole buy local thing, right? It's hard for people in a big city to actually buy all that local because, you know, the farms are spread out and they're going to be some distance away. But now you can live in the center of a city and be a few blocks from where your food is raised. It's interesting that they mention that. I think it's in this piece. They mentioned that, by 2050, 80% of Earth's population will live in cities if we stay on the demographic trend that we're on now. And they're predicting here that by 2025, we will see massive vertical pink farms in most major cities, and that we may even see small vertical pink farm units in our homes in the future. Now, wouldn't that be interesting? I look at my side yard sometimes, and I think, you know, I don't do anything with this space. I had to put a hot tub in or something like that. And then, you know, I look at this and I go, huh, who knows? Maybe in a few years I'll put a...
I'm putting in a vertical pink farm.
Yeah.
I can have all
put a vertical pink farm in my side yard. And, yeah. Grow some, I grow some watermelons and some tomatoes and Well, I can think of all kinds of stuff.
Yeah, and imagine if there was, if there was a self-contained unit that had as part of it a robotic caretaker who could, would keep the right amount of light for each of the plants, the right amount of moisture for each of the plants, could alert you if there's some issue that you're needed on, but would just, provide the perfect environment to grow everything. And, just alert you when it's time. Well, hey, we got food. Wouldn't that be awesome to have in basically what amounts to an appliance that is just delivering the food straight to you right there? I think something like that, a smart device like that would sell.
That's a very cool scenario. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, so there you go. Vertical Pink Farms. We'll count that as good news item number one. Let's move on. We've got a few more pieces of good news before we get to the bad news. What should we do next?
Why don't we talk about atmospheric water harvesting, Phil? If you like, California, Phil, is like it's in the middle of this long drought, and there's so many places in the world where there's just not enough water for the population they have. And, it's long been that, if you can't get it out of the rivers, then we get it out of the oceans and, you just desalinate the water, which is, they're coming up with ways of doing that better all the time. But this is new, Phil. We hadn't really talked. This scenario has not come up in the show before, I don't think. Correct me if I'm wrong, but atmospheric water harvesting, we really haven't talked about before.
I think this is new. I saw that and I thought, hey, isn't this what Luke Skywalker's uncle did? Right?
Yeah, moisture evaporators. That's what he didn't say evaporators. He said evaporators, which means that they were literally taking moisture out of the atmosphere and converting it from a gas into a liquid. So that's what he was doing, and that's what we're talking about here. Now, these structures that in the picture in this article, Phil, look like they're as tall as a skyscraper, but look like giant green screened buildings is what it looks
they
like.
They do, yeah. They're a nice counterpoint to the vertical pink farms, actually, in terms of.
Yeah, exactly, and so somehow it's the air comes in and the water is removed from it, and how effective this would be in a place like Louisiana. Now the only issue with that is we got all the water we can stand.
Yeah, you got plenty of water.
We have no drought here, but it's like 90% humidity. Like hey, you step outside, and, hey, this is nice. Humidity's low today. 90%. You just get used to things like that in Louisiana. I presume in places like California, the air is a good deal more arid, just like the land. But apparently, there's enough water in the air to make this technology effective. So, anyway,
one of the things that was missing from that article actually was any mention of what kind of yield they get, right? It's like how much of the California drought could these overcome, and how big of a, land mass of area would you have to cover with these in order to reclaim what would normally have been gotten from air? Not to disparage the idea, because I think it's a fantastic idea, but I would like to have seen some numbers around that. I think those would have made it real. Instead, we got numbers around what percent of the U.S. almond crop comes from California. Which is 99%.
That's interesting. It's interesting, but it has little to do with the premise. I would just say this, Phil. In my dad's house, he has a room that's rarely used, and so it's not hooked up to the regular air conditioning unit. I'm going somewhere with this. I promise. He's got just a modular unit in the room. It's not connected to a drain or anything. It's just it's just an air conditioner, and it pushes the hot air out and fills the room with cold air. But the only problem with that is that it has a reservoir for collecting the water rather than a place to drip the water. Okay.
Right.
And so, and when the reservoir's full, the air conditioner stops. And it's got about a gallon and a half reservoir.
Interesting. Okay, how long does it take to fill that?
You run that air conditioner unit for about 3 hours.
And it filled it. Wow, okay, well, there you go.
It is absolutely full. And you know, it has this cutoff valve, and, you know, you have to carefully, so it's not spill it on the floor, move and go dump it in the sink, and then you can put it back in and turn it back on. But, yeah, about 3 hours is how long it takes to get a gallon and a half out of, you know, the humid air here in Louisiana. I wonder how long it would take to get that. You probably could run it much longer in a place like California, where you'd have that.
I would imagine.
Water.
Yeah, it would take longer. But the fact that you get a gallon in 3 hours out of a small room, right? I mean, that's not a big unit.
Yeah.
That's pretty impressive. It is in Louisiana, but
It's comparable in size. Phil, this unit is comparable in size to maybe a college refrigerator. Okay, maybe slightly taller than that, but so it's a small unit. But
to put it in realistic terms, in about 3 hours, that gives you what a human being would drink in a day, right? Or more than that, right? So, I mean, that's not bad.
Hey, I may have just given some people in California an idea on how to get some little extra water out there.
Exactly.
Go buy one of those units that has the reservoir on.
There you go. Right. I mean, air conditioners are notoriously expensive to run in terms of power, but the principle is there. All right, we're going to switch to some of these other topics I had listed in the show notes. Although those are two great ones, actually, the vertical pink farms and the moisture evaporators. Let's talk about robot doctors. Did you see this piece in The Economist about computers can recognize this complication of diabetes? Is a really interesting piece about using deep learning algorithms to get computers up to the speed where they're able to look at retina photos and identify a condition that it's one of the side effects of having diabetes. People go blind, and it's detected in the retina. It's something you can see happening in the retina. So, I mean, we've heard about, in fact, it even starts out, the article starts out in this kind of disparaging way. It talks about artificial intelligence can be put to whimsical uses. In 2012, Google announced that one of its computers, after watching thousands of hours of YouTube videos, had trained itself to identify cats. Earlier this year, a secretive AI firm called DeepMind, bought by Google in 2014, reported in Nature that it had managed to train a computer to play a series of classic video games, often better than a human could. And so those sound like odd little experiments. But in fact, the pattern recognition capabilities that computers are learning have tremendous potential applications. And one of them is diagnosing illness. So the story goes on to describe basically a kind of an XPRIZE program that was put together to get a deep learning program to identify this condition that accompanies diabetes, and somebody won with they wrote an algorithm that I think it said has about an 85% accuracy on this, and obviously we're in early days of doing it. You want a computer program that will do it to 99.99. You know, you want it to be better than humans, right? That's what we're always shooting for whenever we program computers to do things that humans have done up to now. But the great thing is you don't have to send it off to an expert, somebody who's trained to how to look at these things. Once you've got that keyed into a computer, you can get an instant result, which people have not been able to have up to this point. And to me, what's exciting about this is, it's a couple of things. First, we're just in the very earliest days of seeing, I think, really amazing stuff from deep learning. In my day job, I get to have some interaction with people who are writing about and looking very deeply into things that are going on around artificial intelligence, machine learning, and deep learning. And it's amazing and almost a little scary how far this is going and how fast progress is occurring with this, and we're just beginning to see what the applications of this will be. And I'm telling you, in a few years, deep learning is going to be touching all aspects of our lives. But I think the things it will be able to do for medicine will be absolutely game-changing. And we've talked a lot about how artificial intelligence, you know, I think has a very bright future for healthcare. And I think healthcare actually has a very bright future in part because of artificial intelligence. I think, you know, in the U.S., we've had this big debate over the last few years about healthcare. And to me, there's a massive technological solution to any conceivable shortage in healthcare that's, you know, somewhere down the road, a little bit over the horizon, but it has to do with having most, if not all, or some, if not most, put it that way, healthcare work farmed out to machines who will be able to do it better than we can. That, you know, that sounds crazy to a lot of people, but then self-driving cars sounded crazy to a lot of people not that long ago. And I think that deep learning is probably going to be one of the things that really pushes this into common practice. We're going to see such tremendous progress with this over the next few years that it will be understood, not just for this particular condition, but just for virtually anything, that if you want to be checked out and you want really accurate results, you know, you'll let a computer do it rather than a human, because it's going to they will have developed the skills, you know, better than humans possibly can. I mean, that's the beauty of having
once one computer's trained, all computers are trained, you know,
exactly.
After that you just copy it over, right? Well, you know, I went to see my eye doctor, Phil. It was about a month or so ago, very recently. Needed new glasses, and they offered a retina scan as, you know, part of the complete eye checkup. And I said, you know, I don't know that I've ever had that done. Let me do it. So they did it, and I was fortunate that it came back as, you know, good-looking retinas you got here. But he had,
good.
I thought it was interesting. He had pictures there, that he was examining, you know, the picture of my retina, and then behind it on the screen he had pictures of various diseased retinas. He had like another normal retina, but he had all these different. And I said, "Tell me about these." And he went through them. With a good retina scan, you can tell all sorts of things about a person's health. Now, eye health is most obvious. You know, you can macular degeneration. Detached retinas, of course, and all sorts of things that you can see with that. But also, he says, you know, here's the picture of someone who is most likely suffering from heart disease. And here's the retina of someone who is at high risk for diabetes. You know, they can see the changes in the eye even before you're diagnosed with full-blown diabetes.
Right.
And so I thought that that was fascinating. So imagine a machine that, you know, it's hooked up to the scope that your eye, you know, the light that the doctor shines in your eye, and is able to just immediately tell the doctor, okay, high likelihood of this problem, and go ahead what it would do is save time to direct the doctor to look in these specific areas, you know, right away, and direct the doctor's attention to certain problems. You know, I think it would tend to keep a lot of problems from being overlooked.
Absolutely.
And,
yeah. The problem with doctors, even when they're great, is, you know,
they get busy.
They're very busy people. There's not enough of them as individuals. There's not enough of them as a group to go around, right? And there's not enough of them as individuals, as, you know, attention span, you know, beings with attention span to go around.
And they're human. They, you know, you get tired, you get bored, you know, the attractive nurse walks by, whatever, you know. Things happen, and you get distracted for 1 second, and then you're off to the next patient. And
right.
You miss diagnosing, this person's about, you know, their pancreas is on its last legs. And, you know, if you'd have caught it at that point, maybe you could, you could treat the situation before they became full blown diabetic. There's, you know, there's all kinds of, There's all kinds of great things that can come from having a machine that could help us with these things.
Absolutely, absolutely. I find that to be one of the most encouraging trends in the world, and I think we're only becoming aware of that. And speaking of extremely encouraging trends that people aren't aware of to the extent that they should be, did you see this story? Extreme poverty likely to drop below 10%. And I encourage everyone to follow the link that we provided there to Euronews.com, because the story is exciting enough, but you got to see the graph that shows the evolution of percentage of people living below the poverty line worldwide. It's just one of the most beautiful things you will ever see in your life. It starts in the year 1990 when the percentage
Which is
was,
not all that long ago, Phil. I mean, 1990 is in the recent past for you and I, isn't it? I mean,
it seems very recent to me. Hard to believe that's considered a long time ago, but it is. You know, some people's whole lifetime ago, so it's a long time ago. But the number was north of 35%. That it looks like it was about 37-38%, somewhere in there at that time. And the drop that it went from 1990 to 2011 is just the most magnificent thing. And I'm sure if they had numbers, all they have are estimates for before that. I mean, there was a time, clearly, when it would have been 90% of the people in the world, right? I mean, we were all hunter-gatherers and, you know, basically everybody was trying not to starve to death or be eaten. But in not just developed times, not just modern times, but 25 years ago, 36-37% of the population of the world lived on, at that time they were calling it less than, I believe, $1.25 a day. They've now upped the figure to $1.90. They're keeping up with the weakening of the dollar. But the drop that takes place between 1990 and 2011, that has got to be unprecedented in human history. It goes from like 35% down to less than 15%. So there is a 20% drop over that 21-year period, and it's still going down to the point that now it's dipped or expected to dip
just
below 10%. By the end of this year. To me, this is great, you know, because it's just great news. It's good news for everyone that's enjoying this boost. Obviously, it's good news, especially for little kids who, you know, have lived in desperate poverty and now their horizons are expanding. It's good news for all those reasons. It's also good news because, to me, this is the answer to anyone who says that any problem is intractable, that any problem is completely unsolvable, that there's anything that you just have to get used to it because things always have to be that way. Because people would definitely have said that about poverty. And to see that kind of progress being made in our lifetimes is just, I don't know. The news doesn't get much better than that, actually, does it? I think that's probably about as good as news
can
get.
Tell you, I think a lot of the genius that will help address future problems, Bill, has been locked up historically in grinding poverty. You know, if you got a special young baby is born, you know, who's a super genius but is in sub-Saharan Africa, and she grows up in that kind of grinding poverty, you know, she's not going to contribute to the world in any meaningful way. Probably, she's just going to find clever ways to stay alive. That's what you have with grinding poverty. The horizons, as you said, are so narrow. But you know, if more people are out of poverty and are able to, you know, perhaps think of beyond what their immediate needs are. You know, people like this can contribute to the world, and that's to me, that's very exciting.
What happens is we're all in the process of opening up our own possibility space, and the whole reason for this topic tonight is to focus on you know, the good possibilities versus the bad ones. But you think about what you're saying, and it's absolutely correct. If you live in that kind of bone-crushing, life-sucking poverty, what can you focus on other than survival, right? What can your life be about other than not starving to death? I mean, it has to be about that, because otherwise you'll die. I mean, it's just, you know, you're going to anyway. But you you know, all of the amazing things that you could do, all the potential that you could have is just, you know, it's just blocked, right? Those possibilities don't exist for you because you can't focus on them. You know, it's not part of your what I call possibility space. And so this, you know, eliminating poverty actually opens up possibilities for people who didn't have them before. And that is just
ends up enriching us all as a result. There's a potential for the entire world to be enriched by that. So,
it's good for awesome, it's a win all the way around. Okay, we're gonna skip Lucid Dreaming Mask because we did two from the IEEE story and we're running out of time. So we've got to jump to our we've done four. So now we've got to do a bad news to give us the 20%.
All right.
And you okay. Actually, I think you wanted to do a whole show about this one, Stephen. So I'll let you explain it. Go ahead.
Well, you know what? It's a bit of a bummer topic. I'm kind of glad we didn't do a whole show. So
this would have been a bit much for a whole show.
Yeah. So for a downer show, this would have been. Basically, this is a guy by the name of Nick Land came up with a theory of why we haven't heard from aliens. You know, why haven't aliens showed up? That's the Fermi paradox, right? Fermi asked, probably back in the 1950s, 1960s, he asked, where is everybody? Given the age of that we know the galaxy to be, et cetera, knowing this, and this, if intelligent life had arisen, we would have expected it to colonize the galaxy by now many times over, and where is everybody? He's got an answer here. He's got an answer. His answer is this. That anytime intelligent life arises, then they inevitably will invent artificial intelligence. Artificial intelligence inevitably then wipes out the creator race. And you go, so that doesn't mean that the AI doesn't colonize the galaxy, right?
Right.
He's saying, but the AI is clever. The AI knows that that if it goes out into the galaxy, it's liable to get in a war with another AI. And so each AI on its own makes the decision to hide. And so that's why we don't see AI. They're busy defending their little solar systems, and they don't get out. They just we had another person who's been on the show before that said, virtual space would probably be more important to an AI race anyway, right? Than actual outer space. So
right. John Smart, right, has talked about that, the transition hypothesis.
That's what it was.
And just the idea that we just keep getting smaller and smaller. We just kind of shrink out of this universe altogether, and we go live in the space between spaces that those guys with the big heads came from in Kingdom of the Crystal Skull, which I like that idea a lot better. I got to say that one explains the Fermi paradox without this dark picture of the universe that he's given us. Right, potentially brimming with intelligent creatures. Right, all hiding from each other, all scared of each other because they all know that they're. I mean, let's face it, ruthless bastards, right? They've all killed off their creators, and they figure that anybody else out there has done the same thing, and they're all a threat to each other. That is a scary picture of the universe.
Yeah, it is, and it's dark. I would just say that I got a couple of problems with that, and it suffers from the same problem that the prime directive hypothesis has, and the prime directive hypothesis, of course, prime directive being from Star Trek, it's another attempted answer to the Fermi paradox is, there's all kinds of alien races out there, but they have a strict hands-off policy to civilizations as primitive as ours, maybe pre-warp or whatever, or pre-singularity civilizations. And, the only problem with that paradox is, that answer is that would have to be all the alien races. Every one of them would have to agree because just one could disagree and show their faces to us, right? So, do every single AI race choose to go into hiding? I think John Smart's idea that AI race just chooses to shrink out of its existence, I think actually makes more sense to me than to every one of them choose to hide rather than fight or conquer or whatever. Seems like one or two AIs would just decide, you know what, I'm taking over everything,
right.
and would head out if that were the case. But I think John Smart's idea might be a little more convincing to me. But I would just add that there's always the other answer to the Fermi paradox is that there's filters. There's there's a funnel to this business of intelligent races that managed to become space-faring civilizations. I would just guess, this is not, based on just a guess, is that life is probably quite common. But you might find it not practically every star system you would come to. Every star probably has liquid water somewhere, and maybe some microbes somewhere. But of those, very few actually have animals that have like a functioning brain. And of those that have a functioning brain, very few of them, get to our level. And those who get to our level, very few of them manage to get out into the stars. I think it's just, we just may find that it's a hard thing to do. And so we don't, lots of civilizations rise and fall, but never even get off their own home world. So I don't know.
The Fermi paradox is kind of bad news in its own right, right? Because it's like, where is everybody?
Yeah.
On the other hand, there's many who will say that no news is good news.
They
haven't shown up and threatened to, melt us down
Mars needs women or whatever.
I got to say, though, you planted another one in my mind that I had never thought of, which would be kind of the null prime directive. Actually, it's a combination of two that you mentioned. Yeah, well, what if there was one out of that universe of AIs hiding from each other that decided, no, I'm just going to take over. And maybe it was the first one. It was the smartest. And it just waits for the others to come along. And as soon as they come along, it just destroys them all. So, there might be one other civilization out there, and it just eliminates all the rest. And it hasn't bothered with us yet because we haven't reached the AI stage yet. It's going to wait for our AIs to wipe us out, and then it's going to come and wipe our AIs out. There. Now, that's a gloomy
thanks for that.
Scenario. Yeah, I don't think that's likely because, again, I think that transcension makes a lot more sense. Who wants to rule this universe, right? When you can go create many times that
A million universes, yeah.
Yeah, with infinitely more complexity. There doesn't seem to be a big upside to that, unless it's just a psychotic, race. And the thing is, there's no arguing with crazy, right? So if there's a race of super intelligent psychopaths out there taking everybody else out, then we got a lot to be afraid of. Otherwise, I take the Fermi paradox as an indication that our future is very mysterious. Either we face a huge filter, or we go someplace else, or there's some other reason that things go in a completely different direction that we haven't even thought of yet. And I guess on that note, I have to say, what's our music this evening, Stephen?
Our music this evening is Anything But Everything by Color Out.
Anything for Everything?
Anything But Everything.
Anything But Everything by Color Out. All right. Well, thanks, Stephen, for putting that together. Thank you all for being with us. We'll be back with an all-new show again this time next week. And until next time, live to see it.
You say you feel like you're always alone. Yeah, you love to pretend, but you've never been one. Flat out of the sand, such a hope. And we all have our reasons. Can't be feeling like you're better off on your own. Cause you and I both know we've traveled down this road so many times before. And we always end up back where we started. Broken down and broken down.